when you're ready, let's start this game.
Welcome to Unstacked and Let's Unwind with best-selling horror author Andy Davidson. Let's find out about his writing process, his novel, The Boatman's Daughter, and perhaps a preview on his upcoming fall release, The Hollow Kind. Hey, this is Sarah from the Bay County Public Library.
Hey, this is Stephen from the Huntsville-Madison County Public Library.
Hi, this is Andy Davidson. Happy to be here. I'm the author of The Boatman's Daughter and In the Valley of the Sun, and forthcoming The Hollow Kind from MCB FSC Original.
Yes, thank you very much for joining us. This is going to be a pleasure for us. I have drugged Sarah into the horror genre,
and I'm kicking and screaming. I'm not screaming anymore.
Yes, and yours was one of the early books that I tried to push on her.
Oh, good.
It was beautifully written, so I'm excited to chat about it.
Always nice to be a gateway drug.
Yeah. Could you introduce our listeners to your latest release, The Boatman's Daughter?
Sure. The Boatman's Daughter came out in 2020, and it is the story of a young woman who lives on the river in an Arkansas swamp, and she is tasked with some nefarious activities for a local cult leader who has seen better days in terms of his cult. It's on the decline, but he's sort of branched out into petty crime, and she works for him. And it's kind of the story of what happens when she makes the choice to defy that authority. And it's got magic and witches and fish children and all sorts of strange things in there too.
It's told from a variety of point of views. We get both Miranda, we get Reverend Cotton, Little Fish, we get everybody's different perspectives, kind of this. Do you have a preference on how you'd like to tell your stories between that singular point of view and the multiple point of views? I know this is kind of similar to In the Valley of the Sun. It was a multi-take.
Yeah, I like to keep a limited point of view in a chapter. So sort of as you would when say writing a short story. You stick to one character's point of view for a small amount of time, and ultimately a multiplicity of points of view kind of make up the whole story. So I do often sort of approach something from multiple points of view. I haven't yet written a first-person novel. I haven't written yet a novel limited to only to one character's perspective. I've done that plenty of times with short stories, it seems like, but novels for me are kind of difficult to sustain over that long haul with just one point of view.
And The Boatman's Daughter, it just immerses you immediately into this dark, heavy, swampy bayou setting. And though it's set in our universe, there's a ton of world building. So do you start with the world building first, or your characters, or how do you kind of start that writing process?
I generally start with an idea, just a simple sort of convergence of two or three things. So in the case of The Boatman's Daughter, for example, I believe it was the convergence of wanting to write something that was set in my home state of Arkansas and relatively close to where I grew up as well. So talking about Southwest Arkansas, South Central Arkansas, I wanted to write something that took the characters of The Tempest and sort of turned them on their head a little bit and played around with that. And then I also wanted to write something that was rooted in a sort of childhood love of a movie called The Legend of Boggy Creek, which was based on true incidents, supposedly, that happened in the town of Falk, Arkansas, which is sort of a prototypical town for Milan, Arkansas, in the book. So those three things came together. And then once you get that in the same pot, it starts to sort of almost build itself in terms of, you know, where you're going to set the story, you know, who's going to be a player. But in terms of the actual writing of the story, I usually start with maps. I look at the region. The region is the place that I generally start. And I guess that was true in the case of this book, just in terms of wanting to write about that place. But yeah, so I make maps and I kind of plot out where the characters are going to be throughout the course of the narrative. What are the limitations of the land where they are. And once I figure all of that out, that sort of confines them to the story and gives me the parameters for what that story is going to be.
Speaking of the Fook monster, are you a cryptid, I wouldn't say, I'm not going to use the word hunter, but just, you know, aficionado?
I like a good Bigfoot story as much as the next person, I'll put it that way. I would not say I've been to any conventions or, and I think we have one here in Georgia up in Rome, which
you
is
do.
Not too far. Yeah, I forget what it's called, but it seems like every region has their stories. You know, there's Swamp Ape down there where you guys are, and then there's Bigfoot up north, and then we have there's the Fook monster is what they call it, but it's basically the same thing, Bigfoot. So, yeah.
I'm not going to be tipping my hand too much, but I may have looked into that particular convention y'all have in Georgia, and it may be a family trip here in the next year or so.
Oh, good deal. That's fine.
Nothing like the weird stuff just to really, you know, bring a family together. The Legend of Boggy Creek. I remember much younger watching Monster Vision with Joe Bob Briggs, and they did a big old cult classic kind of thing on it. It's a great bad movie.
It is. It's a wonderful example of, I guess, how a thing can be both brilliant and beautiful and also terrible at the same time. I mean, it makes no bones about being a great film. And I think in terms of its place in the world of horror films, it has a very strong place because I think it was one of the first, not found footage, but one of the first sort of pseudo-documentarian approaches to telling a story. Well, there was a second film, the guy's from Arkansas, Charles Pierce, and the second film ended up on Mystery Science Theater, I think, The Legend of Boggy Creek 2, and it is genuinely an awful movie. Like, it's the kind of movie that I think even the person, the director who was making it, probably knew he was doing a terrible, terrible thing when he was making that film.
It's capturing lightning in a bottle, and sometimes you just can't do it no matter what you try.
Right.
I'm looking at you, Netflix, with season 2 of Tiger King.
Yeah, my wife and I were fans of that first series, and we watched a few episodes of the second series, and we just sort of thought, you know, this feels like we're really struggling to pull out something to make money off of here. But yeah, we kind of ditched that one about 3 episodes in.
Same.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your overall writing and editing process like?
Man, right now it's very scattered. It seems to change from book to book, right? So like the first book that I wrote in 2017, I put it through about 14 or 15 drafts over a period of years. And that was just grabbing time when I could, right? And then the second book, Boatman's Daughter, that I wrote in probably 2018 was when the first draft of that book came together. It came together much quicker, but I do think it was a different process from the first one in that I kind of knew with a stronger sense going into it what the story was from start to finish. A lot of Invalid Sun changed from iteration to iteration. Boatman's Daughter stayed pretty much the same through, I would say, 6 or 7 drafts before it saw an editor, before it was accepted. And I guess that process was just simply, you do the outlining, you do the mapping, you do the story planning, and then you sit down and just chapter by chapter, you write it. So I tend to write very long outlines. So I'll write a 16-page outline. And from that 16-page outline, I'll just build that out into the book. And sometimes it includes dialogue, sometimes it includes things that actually make it into the book, wording and phrase-wise. But this last book that I wrote really quickly, The Hollow Kind, over the course of 20, time is just this collapsing black hole now. It was the summer of 2022, it was during the pandemic, and it was right after things locked down, I wrote that book. And I think I got back to the revision of that about a year later. So it was a whole thing that came pretty quickly and then went through a couple of more drafts.
there's was a grittiness to The Boatman's Daughter, which kind of reminded me of like True Detective season one, but with this more supernatural elements added in. So there's the elements of true crime, poverty, survival, the drug trade. What made you decide to merge both true crime horror and supernatural horror?
I approach horror with a very kind of sympathetic eye toward the monsters. And I have less of a sympathetic eye for human monsters. And what I wanted to do with this book, I think with all of my books, there's always going to be this blending of crime and horror with some other aspect, some third aspect, like the first book was the Western, the second book, it was the sort of folk horror angle of the swamp and whatnot. And so I think it could easily be historical as well in terms of what that other element is. But I think in terms of The Boatman's Daughter, I just wanted to write a book about bad people doing bad things in a place that didn't want them to be there, a magical place. And so that was the idea there. Yeah.
When you mentioned that you wanted the creature or the horror creature to be more sympathetic, is it almost like Creature from the Black Lagoon with the fish boy, where there is almost this, you have empathy for the creature as well?
Yeah, I always think that creatures who are in their natural setting don't know their creatures. So in this case, with Little Fish, he was born into a world that he knew nothing of. It just simply became his world. And he accepted that. And I always find sympathy for characters that don't know they're the monster. And in that case, he doesn't know he's ugly. He doesn't know he's not like other people because he's never met another child before. And so, yeah, and that was kind of a riff on Caliban in The Tempest. I think Caliban in The Tempest is not a very sympathetic character. He does horrible things. But there's a painting by Hogarth that depicts The Tempest, and Caliban is in the painting. And he's just sort of this misshapen, lumpen boy off to the side carrying a bundle of sticks. And he looks very pitiable. And that was kind of my thought behind Little Fish, because I wanted him to be a pitiable, empathetic character that readers would love and would desperately hope nothing bad would happen.
And I saw that you did almost like a collection of images to kind of get you inspired for The Boatman's Daughter, including the images from the Tempest. Can you provide any like sneak previews of any inspiration for The Hollow Kind, just so we kind of get a feel for the new title coming out in the fall?
Yeah, The Hollow Kind is set in two timelines. It's set in summer of 1989, I would say, I think July. And it's also set in the early 1900s through the 1930s. So these two timelines sort of move back and forth in the novel from one to the other. And so image-wise, the 1980s, a lot of the things that I sort of had in my head that I was writing kind of to, as if they were almost a beat of music, was a lot of the images that I, as a kid, was very fond of, comic books and superheroes and things like that, things that a kid would draw. And in the other timeline, which deals a lot with the history of all things, turpentining in Georgia, the naval storage industry, there was a lot of imagery that dealt with maps and imagery that dealt with the woods, trees, forests, that sort of thing. Old pine trees.
We have a lot of turpentine history in our area as well.
Yeah, yeah. Florida was actually, I kind of borrowed from several things that kind of historical records and things that I found in Florida for here. I think Florida and North Carolina had a bigger turpentine industry than Georgia did, actually, but, it's fiction.
We did a previous interview with Grady Hendrix when he put out Final Girls, and he had started that book with the question of what is wrong with them. So far what you've written, I mean, from everything we've gotten, you're a super normal, nice guy. So what's wrong with you that you find this, that you find your work in these horrific books?
Well, I would say, and this is an answer that I would give to anybody who asks this question, whether it is asked in kindness and sympathy, or whether it is asked in genuine befuddlement. I would say that what's wrong with me is actually what's entirely right with me. I think the question is kind of a dark reversal on other on people who don't understand horror. I would say to them, what is wrong with you? Because I've had a lot of experiences with people. In fact, when I did my first book, promotional material for my first book, when I was promoting it, I did a book club in a little town here in Georgia. And I had a woman come up to me and she said, so you're the one with the deranged mind for writing this. And people, believe it or not, people will say that to your face and mean it quite sincerely. So what I would say is I would flip that around and I would say, if you don't understand horror, if you don't respond to horror in a way that is somehow relevant, or you don't see the genre as relevant, I would say, what news are you not reading? I would say, what part of the world are you not listening to? That's kind of a rambling answer, but I really think that horror as a genre has a lot to say, maybe more so almost than any other genre, about the human condition.
Do you find a kind of catharsis in writing this style?
I don't know. I'm not sure what I would be catharting, you know, like I'm not sure what I'm getting out of me in doing that. I'm not an angry person. I'm not a violent person. I have a little bit of temper sometimes, I guess, when things don't go the way they're supposed to go. But I guess we all do. And that's sort of the point, is that I don't think there's anything unique about me, or that anything that I get out of this that's unique that any other writer would get out of, like, writing about any other genre. I think in one way, we just write the books we want to read. So I, as a reader, love to read horror. But I think, too, like, yeah, I don't know. I think about like crime writers. Nobody ever accuses a crime writer of committing crime, or you know, it's sort of the response that we as teachers sometimes get to Edgar Allan Poe. You read something that Poe wrote, oh, Poe must have been very sad and deranged, and in some ways, I guess he was. So maybe he's a bad example.
And I have a follow up to all of that is. Do you have other writers in your writing circle who also write horror? And then if so, what do you guys geek out about when you're reading each other's work?
I have one other writer whose work I read every now and then, who he'll request me to read something. And I sort of, that favor goes both ways. Mm-hmm. But it's always it's really more on a technical level, you know, like in terms of like before something's published. Now, after it's published, I think the thing that I love the most about other writers in the horror genre is when I see things that I never could have conceived of that actually frighten me, you know, things that you wish you had written as a writer. That always was the thing that I really get the most excited about, is when I read a passage in a book and I say, man, I wish I had written that, because that's beautiful. Whether it's scary, whether it's poetic, whether it's, you know, lyrical, just effective writing. That's pretty much it.
That makes sense.
You started off your writing career, from what I kind of put together, wanting to be a screenwriter. Is that your default writing style?
No. I would say I was considering the idea of being a screenwriter more so than I was thinking I'm going to be a screenwriter. One of the things I quickly learned about screenwriting is it's very difficult, not only just on a technical level, but it's very difficult in terms of breaking into that world compared to, which is kind of odd, because you would say, some people would say, well, breaking into, you know, the world of novel writing is equally hard and complex, but I never felt that, which is not to say I thought it was easy, but I just thought, you know, screenwriting, there's this whole set of other challenges that are there, like your location, where you are, who you know, do you have an agent, who's going to read these scripts, and everything that I've learned since I've become a published writer, and I actually have a a film agent now and have not had anything made or bought or optioned, is that it's even more difficult than I thought it would be. So like it's a good thing I didn't commit my life to that enterprise, because that would be a total failure by now.
You attended Ole Miss, where you received your master's in fine arts. You kind of said you trained yourself to become a literary writer, not a genre writer. You never had any ambitions to be thought of as important in the way literary writers are often regarded. I think it was, I didn't write for a long time, and it was as there was nothing to compel me to write and lacked something to say and a way to say it. So what was it that you found that finally made you say, this is something I have to say and say it so well?
Well, I think when I got out of my writing program in the early 2000s, it was 2004, I spent 3 years in Mississippi teaching online. And in that 3 years, I was a fully online teacher. I had a weird schedule. I had no structure to my life at all. I would get up at 5 a.m. or go to bed at 5 a.m. and get up at, 2 p.m. And there was no reason for me to not be that way, because nothing was telling me don't be that way. And I think that impacted my creativity, just not having much of a sense of place in the world or purpose at that time, just kind of treading water as a human being. And I had been writing for 3 years steadily in a program that the work that I was producing while, was publishable, it wasn't really reflective of what I wanted to do as a writer or what I had grown up loving as a writer, as a reader. And so I really didn't know what I was doing for a while. And I think I would say this is true for almost anybody, unless you're just a genius. I would say it takes a good number of years of getting out into the world and living life a little bit before you have a voice that develops into something, not necessarily that you have something that you want to say, but that is a voice that people respond to and listen to. And so I think I needed to be out in the world. I think I needed to be married. I think I needed to have a little bit of heartache and tragedy. And all of these things go into making you a better writer and hopefully a better person. So that's kind of it.
What components do you enjoy most in Gothic horror, and what for you defines a Southern Gothic horror novel?
I think I'm drawn to Southern Gothics because of their use of location and place. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that I really love about them, is the South. And that's where the MFA also comes in, to kind of go back to the previous question, is, one of the things that I really loved about getting an MFA at a university where there were all of these Southern writers is that you really get steeped in literature of the South. And so your identity as a Southerner, for better or worse, becomes part of like what you write about and how you write about it. And that the place really seeps into your work. And in this case, I felt like there's a connection between the Southern Gothic and the place. You have or the Gothic genre in place. And definitely when you put the Southern spin on that, you get things like Faulkner's Absalom Absalom, or, any of the works of like Barry Hanna sometimes have this sort of Gothic quality to them, or Flannery O'Connor. And so, all these writers that I love were doing this. And so I kind of thought, well, that's a good place to start, because that's the thing you love to read. And I've sort of run with that in every book I've written. Place is a key component.
We are a PG style podcast, so we play a game here that Sarah makes me rename. You might know it as something else, but we're going to call it Mary Kiss Ditch. And I've got a couple categories that I'm going to cleverly try to disguise on you and let you pick which one I want to answer here. So our topics are dark Gothic nights, fangs for the memories, woodland scenic, and bona fide films.
Okay.
So which one of those would you like to try?
Let's go with bona fide film.
All right. So we will be talking about Coen brother movies.
Oh, yay.
So you're going to kiss, marry, ditch these three movies: Fargo, No Country for Old Men, and True Grit.
You marry them all.
I know, right? This is a tough one for you.
Yeah, right. No, we're talking about Coen Brothers. That's going to be the answer every time. It's like there's nothing that's extraneous. So maybe we should pick another category.
Your pick. Which one?
Let's go with the Fang.
Fangs for the Memories, vampire movies. Mm-hmm. Lost Boys, Near Dark, or Let the Right One In?
Oh, my gosh. It's Mary again. I guess the difference between Kiss and Mary is that Mary is the long-term commitment that you would never get rid of. Kiss is the
exactly
thing you like, but you can discard, or you can move on from it or something.
Yep.
Okay. No, those are all Mary. Yeah.
Dark Gothic Knights would have been Batman stories or actors, your call on which one. We could have gone Dark Knight Returns, Long Halloween, or Killing Joke, or Keaton, Bale, or West.
Wait a minute. Okay, let's do this one. So go through that again, and let's do the one. Yeah.
Okay. The we've got the story. So we got Dark Knight Returns, mm-hmm. Long Halloween, or Killing Joke.
Mary or Mary, yeah. All three Mary.
And then Keaton, Bale, or West. The Batmans that you would keep or lose.
Mary, ditch, Mary.
So the only one we're getting rid of is Bale. Okay.
And that is a late development. I'm actually doing a podcast pretty soon with some friends of mine to talk about Batman. And in kind of prepping for that, we have been rewatching the Batman film. And we revisited The Dark Knight just recently. And The Dark Knight is one of those films that's beloved. And I loved it when it came out. I haven't thought about that movie in a bad light. I hated The Dark Knight Rises, but those reasons that I hated it had nothing to do with Christian Bale. But yeah, we recently rewatched it, and I was sort of struck by how I just thought Christian Bale's Batman was fine. His Bruce Wayne is much better. I like his Bruce Wayne. I don't like the way his Batman talks. I don't like the growly, roaring thing that he does. It just seems like that's not going to be easy to sustain over the career, lifetime career of being Batman. Your throat's going to eventually just give out on you.
It's going to be really awkward now because the rest of this interview I've got to do in that voice of folk, Woodland Scenics was folk horror stories where you would have picked Witchfinder General, Wicker Man, or Blood in Satan's Claws.
Man. Again, it's like you've been, as the Christofferson song says, you've been reading my mail.
I do a little bit of research here.
You're doing good research. This is deep stuff. All three are wonderful. That's sort of the trilogy of folk horror movies that sort of sets up the whole template of what folk horror can be in film. So can't get rid of any of those. Yeah, those are wonderful. My favorite of the bunch is Blood on Satan's Claw.
It's a good one. I didn't realize I hadn't seen it until we started watching the Woodlands Darkened Forest. Mm-hmm. There's a new documentary on Shudder that's like 3 hours of folk horror stuff. And it was like, well, I haven't seen these. So now I've got to stop this and watch these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great documentary.
And since I know nothing about Blood on Satan's Claw, can you give just a brief introduction? What is
Yeah,
this?
sure. well, Blood on Satan's Claw is, I guess it goes in a category with, you know, The Wicker Man and Witchfinder General. The Witchfinder General and Blood on Satan's Claw are both historic films that mm-hmm. were made in England in the late 60s, early 70s that Witchfinder General deals with the witch hunts in East Anglia. Vincent Price plays the character Witchfinder General, who's based on a real character in history, whose basic MO is he travels the countryside looking for women to murder in the service of witch finding, which puts money in his pocket. And so that's a really good movie. It's very nihilistic. Blood on Satan's Claw is pretty nihilistic too, but it's about a group of children in a village who are sort of overcome by the presence of evil. They're taken one by one under the influence of Satan. When in the opening scene of the film, a bit of bone and a skull is found in one of the fields by a young man who's plowing the fields. It's a really grisly image of a skull with it with an eye and a worm. It's really disgusting and awful. But it, you know, sort of madness and hysteria ensues throughout the village among the children. And there's a great part in there for a young woman that I think at the time, so I think she was pretty young. I think she might have been 17 or so, 16, who plays sort of the heavy, the lead kid that murdering other people in order to bring about the resurrection of the devil. So, you know, it's a fun movie, fun time.
I'll add it to my watch list. So you've included several iconic supernatural creatures in your works, from witches, ghosts, vampires. Are there new legends or folklore that you hope to explore in your work in the future?
A good question. I always joke with my publisher that, you know, I want to make sure they want to publish what I write. And I say, so, okay, if I'm going to write that mummy novel, you're going to publish it, right? But I think werewolves are something I'm really keen on doing. I love werewolves, and I've always wanted to write a werewolf novel that does something kind of fun with it. They can be done so badly if they're not done well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that's probably the only thing right now that I've consciously got in my head. Maybe I'm also thinking about grave robbers. There's mm-hmm. a lot of fun stuff with EC Comics and grave robbing and those old Tales from the Crypt.
I've been reading several titles where it's set in like the late 1800s with the anatomist societies and a lot of grave robbing for, so the Corpse Queen and Anatomy, a Love Story are both kind of along those lines for YA. It's great. A trend right now. I don't know why, but the Resurrection Men.
yeah, I absolutely. There's a great Boris Karloff movie called Body Snatchers that's been sort of a template for what I kind of want to do. But anyway. Yeah.
And Stephen and I have already talked previously on the podcast that there's not a lot of female werewolves. So that's a possibility. Female werewolves.
Funny you should mention that.
So what started your interest in horror?
Stephen King. Right out of the gate. I think Stephen King when I was a kid. I read It. That was the book that did it for me. Before that, I had read Watchers by Dean Koontz. And that was my mom who kind of gave me that book and said, you should read this. And I was probably in the fifth grade when I read it. So that was probably the first adult horror that I read. So I would credit Koontz with a little bit of that too. But yeah, definitely Stephen King, which every horror writer will say is the boring answer. And, you know, but that's just the truth.
There's often a trope in horror writing where people have a huge disagreement on whether or not it's better to see or not see the monster. Where do you kind of stand on this?
I think you hold it back until the right moment, but I think it's good to show it in part because, well, like Jaws is the classic example, right? So we don't see the shark in Jaws really, really well for at least a good hour into the film. And what the mind creates is much more effective than what, you know, Spielberg could show us. And that, in part, was out of necessity with that film, because the shark was a terrible, clunky piece of equipment that wouldn't work. I think in horror, especially in writing, you're already entering into this agreement with the reader who is creating so much of the book themselves in their mind based on what you tell them. And so I think there's no reason on earth why you can't share your own perspective on what the monster is, you know, tease that out a little bit, because the reader is still going to make up in his or her mind whatever that thing is. They're going to see something totally different than what you see in your head. But yeah, in terms of the effectiveness of the horror, I think showing the monster is good at a certain point, because ultimately, I think in my fiction, there's always got to be the confrontation with evil. The monster always has to be fought, or the monster has to be seen because nobody sees the monster. I mean, monsters are sympathetic, bad creatures. I think if I think about Frankenstein, that's sort of my conception of monster. If we hadn't seen Frankenstein's monster, that would have been completely ineffective. We would have been more afraid of him rather than empathetic for him. So
There's times I missed part of your answer there, but I caught the part where you were talking about Jaws and out of necessity and how, you know, sometimes it's, I think back to Aliens where we went so long without it, but then again, you paid a lot of money for H.R. Giger, so you got to bring it out at some point.
Well, and that's the real effectiveness of film, is that film is imagistic and film shows us things. And so if we went to a movie like Alien and we spent 2 hours in the dark waiting to see a giant alien and we didn't get it, we'd be really upset and disappointed. But I was also saying, in the case of Frankenstein, for example, what we see of the monster has another effect on us. It makes us empathetic to the monster. The monster is a character that we sympathize with and care for. And so I think you can't tell a story sometimes without showing the monster, because the monster is the protagonist in some way.
And we kind of get that a little bit in the Valley of the Sun, where you've got a serial killer style character there, but you kind of, when we get to from the different perspectives, it humanizes the various monsters that are in that book.
Yeah. And Travis is in that book. Travis is a character that's very difficult to have empathy with in some ways, right out of the gate. And so I always was kind of proud of the fact that it is a big challenge in that book was to take someone that awful and actually create, by the end of the novel, a sense of empathy and connection with that character. So even as he descends into a darker and darker place, he's also trying to claw his way out of it. So that's one of the great things that we can do as fiction writers, is make people feel things with characters that we wouldn't typically feel.
What was it like to both write and release a title during the pandemic?
I got lucky with the release. The Boatman's Daughter came out in February of 2020, and my very last event that I did was in Arkansas. Okay, so that was in March, early March, right before the official lockdown kicked in. Our spring break, I teach at a four-year school here in Georgia, and the question had just been floated into the air when I got home from that about moving classes online for the rest of the semester. So that question was still up in the air. I do remember being on the road a couple of times and having a sense of unease. The first time I was in Memphis, and I had an event the next day, and I got there and I woke up and I went down to the breakfast bar, and I had been listening to the news on the way out and kind of following along with the progress of things. I remember a guy walked in, started serving his food at the buffet, and sneezed. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that just normally you would think, well, that's gross, but it doesn't fill you with like deep dread the way it did. And I'll never forget that feeling. It was so ominous compared to just what you would just normally find to be disgusting. And so I got home from that trip right before things shut down. And so I was lucky in that respect. And the book, even when bookstores closed, I was also fortunate that the book kept selling well. I think there were some good word of mouth had generated by then. Writing a book during the pandemic was not as weird, in the sense that it's what I would normally do anyway, just spend time at home working. But in some ways, you did sort of question everything you did. I remember thinking, I'm writing this book. I don't know when it's going to come out. I don't know if there's going to be paper for printing of it. Who knows? So that was kind of a strange experience, but not as strange as being on the road. So I weirdly kind of avoided both of those deeper problems. But yeah, I know of friends of mine who have books coming out right now who are dealing with things like glue shortages. And there were people who had books coming out last fall that were dealing with paper shortages, or, you know, just all sorts of strange things. So it had a very strong impact across the industry.
I can tell you here, I'm located here in Alabama, and right now they haven't been able to print state tax forms because there's the paper shortage. So you know it's bad when the government can't even get their money.
Yeah.
You have a new book coming out October, I think-ish, called Hollowkind. Are you able to tell us anything about it? Is this the Smoking and the Bandit meets Dracula that you've hinted at so many times?
I wish it was. I'm a fool for ever saying that. That's gonna dog me for the rest of my writing career when I never write that book. 30 years from now, someone's gonna ask about it. No, this was a book that I had not intended to write. So that was maybe the strangest experience for the pandemic for me, was that I was going to write a werewolf book next. I was going to work on a werewolf that was a Western I was going to do the werewolf book that I wanted to do. And my publisher very wisely sort of said, you know, that might not be the best fit for a career trajectory at this point. And I thought that was good wisdom. I agreed, so I set it aside. And then in March of 2020, when I had gotten home and probably had a little time to think about it, this was probably actually April, I started on The Hollow Kind. The Hollow Kind came out of an idea to tell a haunted house story, but in a different kind of unconventional way. So maybe it wasn't so much a haunting as it was a possession by an actual entity, not a ghost, but a creature. And so I worked on that book through the summer and got it together. And the book that's coming out is basically going to be a story about a young woman who has fled her troubled marriage, and she's taken her 11-year-old son with her, and she's fled to a turpentine estate that she's inherited from her grandfather, who's just passed away. And what she's going to find there on this place that she, as the Carpenter song says, a place that we can hide away, what she's going to find is not a sanctuary. It's not a safe place. It's a place that's actually very dangerous, and is very happy that she's come home. So that's the story, basically.
From what I understand, your wife is a pen and paper gaming aficionado.
She
and,
is.
And are you yourself a gamer? How has her influence and that gaming helped you in your writing?
I'm not a gamer. She's been doing it since she was in high school or middle school, and I missed it. I missed that boat. But yeah, I mean, she's a huge help in some ways. I mean, you have a storyteller who understands the instinctive mechanisms of character and story and how those things go together. And so whenever I'm stuck for something, if I go to her and I give her the problem, inevitably I come away from it with an answer of some sort. She helps me sort of get through the rough part. And so there's a lot of wisdom there. I'm very grateful for that.
And to continue with just the family household. Librarians love cats. I hear you love cats too. So can you tell us their names and how they help with your writing process?
Can I tell you their names? Oh, gosh. Okay.
Or a favorite cat. Or
No. I'll do it. There's just a lot of them. Let's start. We have Ole Anderson, who is our polydactyl cat named for the Hemingway story, the boxer. So that's Ole. There is Lucas, our sort of half-blind, part Siamese cat that we found in a shoebox at the maintenance plant at school. He is named for George Lucas because we got him on May the 4th. He was weaned by a dog because he had not been weaned when we found him, and we took him to the local pet shelter, and there was no cat that could do it, but a dog stepped in and did the job. That's two. We also have Aldo, named for Aldo Rain in Inglourious Bastards. He's one of our Tarantino cats. He's very funny. He's a rescue. All of our cats are rescues. We have our outdoor cat, Penny, who comes in. She's the queen. That's four. So I said, okay. We have Beatrix, who is another of our Tarantino cats from Kill Bill. We have Ahsoka Tano. She is another of our Star Wars cats. That's six. I know there's one more that's an indoor. This is unbelievably hard to do when you're on the spot. We got another one. And then I'm going to be so upset when I forget or I remember who it was. And then we have two more outdoor cats that we call the Blackwood sisters, Connie and Meerkat. Yeah, we got a lot of cats.
Do they help your writing process at all?
No. They are nothing but impediments to the writing process.
Obviously, writers are notorious for, you know, being that joke of people wanting to see what's in their search history. So we have to ask this question. Strangest thing in the search history.
Just the other day, check this and see, but I think just the other day I bookmarked something. Okay, I have ship's reporter interview with Bela Lugosi. I'm looking through some of my other stuff. Here's like common lumber terms. this is, no, that's not writing related, but that is the strangest thing. That's the buttermilk brined turkey of your Thanksgiving dinner. So somehow that made it into my writing folder.
So is that the plan for this year, buttermilk brine?
No, I don't know why that's there. I've never done that, and I have no plans to do that at all.
And we are a library podcast, so how have libraries influenced your life or impacted your life?
Yeah, big time. When I was a kid, we had a library in my hometown in Arkansas that was a wonderful brick and mortar library, very old. There was a very sweet elderly woman that worked there. She was the best. I think it was through her that I found the Hardy Boys and started reading Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew. I would go and spring home as many as I could. I read a lot of adult fiction through the library. I read Daphne du Maurier's The Bird from a collection that I checked out at the library when I was probably 12. So libraries have been really foundational, and you guys do amazing work. And all the way up until recently, like I think libraries have been a big part of helping to keep my books on shelves. Becky Spratford, who does book riot reviews, I think, or something like that. She booklet. And she's been a tremendous proponent of horror, I know, the genre. So, yeah, love libraries.
Do you have any kind of writing habits or rituals that you like, certain comfort foods, music, or food that you have to have in order to get going?
Nah, I always think about writing rituals like in Misery, you know, like he has the match, he has the champagne, he has the... And all of that doesn't work out well for him. And so I think it's better not to have writing rituals. Don't have things that you do that your number one fan could know about and trap you with. No, really, I don't have much. I sit in the same spot generally to write. And I go through a process, but I don't have to have a certain thing near me. I don't have to have a certain kind of coffee cup or whatever.
You have any... turn-ons or turn-offs as a reader or watcher?
I'm pretty open-minded. I think it takes a lot for me as a reader now to love a book. That's an interesting development as a writer, that the more books you read, the more you write, your tastes become much more targeted. For me now, I look for a certain threshold of language with a book before I can say I really am into this book. If the words aren't, you know, doing it for me in the way they're arranged and written, then that can be an impediment.
You are predominantly known as a genre style writer. A lot of times people, you know, have opinions on that. Do you think it's a bad thing to be known as a genre writer?
No, I think it's a bad thing to be known as a literary writer, because there's a limitation to that. The genre writing, I don't think genre writing is a pigeonholing of writers. I think it's a targeted classification, you know. Literary is a kind of broad catch-all term that encompasses a lot of bad ideas about books, you know, like the nice way of saying something is literary is saying that it's character-driven and it uses language in an elevated way. But most genre work is character-driven and uses language in an elevated way. I mean, most books that are written use language in some elevated fashion. So I think literary writing carries an inherent snobbery to it that I don't go for. I don't like that. So yes, I'm proud and happy to be a genre writer.
Looking back on it too, I mean, I'm not sure where this tendency started, but I mean, some of the greatest classics would fall in, if they were written today, would definitely be in a genre style. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. without Frankenstein is considered a literary classic now, but that's definitely sci-fi, borderline horror kind of stuff.
Sure. And I think about, there are plenty of writers who are known for being the great writers that wrote in genre and wrote published books to success. I think about Faulkner. Faulkner's major success in his career was Sanctuary, which is basically a kind of potboiler, by his own admission, a potboiler detective novel, crime novel. And it made him a lot of money when nothing else at that point had. So I think people who knock genre writing, you know, there's not a full picture there being given of what genre is.
Seeing so, I mean, you've kind of given us a hint with the naming of the cats and such, but do you have favorite fictional heroes or villains or heroines or villainesses?
You can't beat Dracula. That's something I kind of, you can't beat the clown and it, as far as villains go. Heroes, though, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I've never thought about it, to be honest. My favorite book is The Night of the Hunter by Davis Grubb, which is a book that, you know, some people know, some people don't. More people are familiar with the film that was made from it, which is, you know, circle back to Coen Brothers, is mentioned and referenced many times throughout the Coen Brothers work. But yeah, I would say that the children in that book, the two children, the brother and the sister, are among my favorites. I think that Maddie Ross in True Grit is one of my favorite literary heroines. I think there's a wonderful quality to Chief Brody in Jaws, as far as film goes, that you have this everyman who doesn't want to do this thing. This is the last thing he wants to do. It's not up his alley. This is not what he signed up for. He wanted peace and quiet. Now he's got to go out into the ocean and hunt down a massive man-killing shark. Not his expertise as a New York police officer. So I think characters who find themselves out of their comfort zone, and that same can be true, can be said of Maddie, it's true of Maddie Roth. She is always in command of her environment, but she is not in her element when she is out on the trail with Rooster Cogburn. And so that's the best for me, is when a character is in it too deep and either knows it or doesn't know it.
And this question reminded me of another question that I didn't have listed, but we always ask, what are you currently reading or watching?
I am currently reading Sundial by Catriona Ward. I love her stuff. It's a really good book. I'm also reading, I always have two or three books scattered around. I'm reading the novel Nightmare Alley that Del Toro's film was based on, and also the 1950s noir was based on. My wife and I are big fans of Severance. We just got into Severance on Apple Plus, and we're loving that show. It's creepy.
I heard good things, so I'll have to add that to the next watch list. Mm-hmm.
She's trying to convince me to do this Apple Plus.
I know. Thing.
Tell me how much I've missed out on Ted Lasso and some other stuff.
That was why we got it. Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
So good.
You have totally missed out if you haven't seen Ted Lasso.
First season, perfect season. Nothing wrong with it. Second season, not quite as good, but still really good.
Yeah.
This has made me think about something, because you have said at one point that vampires need to be scary. And I want to defend comedy vampires here, because What We Do in the Shadows is my go-to vampire right now. So do vampires truly have to be scary?
Well, I think the vampires that we take seriously as vampires have to be scary. What We Do in the Shadows is one of those wonderful exceptions, right? Although, you know, you can make the case that at the time when they need to be scary, they're scary, you know, in that show. That show doesn't completely sidestep the fact that these are vampires who do terrible things. But yeah. I'll give you that one.
So it's been such a pleasure interviewing you. Do you have anything that you would like to share with our listeners?
Yes, I have a book coming out in October, The Hall of Time. It's coming out in hardback, so I'm excited about that. It's my first hardback release with FSG. I've been doing some work along on short story writing, and I have a couple of stories that are possibly going to be coming out soon, sometime this year as well. So I'm pretty excited about that. You can check those out as they release through my social media. I'm on Twitter at TheAndyDavidson, and my website is TheAndyDavidson.com. So if you want to learn anything else, that's it.
Thank you very much for taking some time to spend with us today. I'm sorry this has been our most brutal interview as far as technical issues have come, but we do appreciate you taking your time. And I cannot express how much I have enjoyed reading your work so far, and I look forward to many, many books to come. And I will try to let the smoky die.
Well, let's put it on the back burner for a while. But yeah, thanks, Steve. And Sarah, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Andy, for joining us on Unstacked. The Boatman's Daughter is available in the library collection for checkout.
It can also be purchased through your favorite bookstore and online vendors. Also, check out Andy's website, TheAndyDavidson.com.
Stay safe and read, my friend. It's good for you. Bye.
Bye.